Welcome, Green Future Growers, Progressive Radio Network listeners, and anybody who's new to the show. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer, and let's get growing.
Happy Mother's Day to you. Happy Mother's Day to you. Happy Mother's Day, dear mom. Happy Mother's Day to you. So, last weekend, somehow I managed to come home without my computer after I've been waiting to publish this interview with the amazing managers from Young's Farm on Long Island that my mom requested because she's the best mom ever. She totally got me into organic gardening, totally got me started loving to eat healthy, and she's a fantastic gardener, and she loves Young's Farms. And she kept bugging me, and so I finally reached out to them and did this amazing interview, which I know, listeners, you're going to love because they just dropped so many golden seeds, especially if you're interested in becoming a market farmer. But anybody who's into just growing super healthy vegetables. So thank my mom, thank Tim and Aiden for sharing with us, and sorry it's a week late, but if you know me, sometimes it's the way I roll. So happy Mother's Day to all you amazing moms out there. Sorry if it's late, and hope you have a wonderful week. Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast today. It is Saturday, March 24th, and I am just like ecstatic to introduce my guest today because it's a place near and dear to my heart. I've been there. My mom's been bugging me to get them on the line. We've had some scheduling problems, to say the least, and they've been super patient, and they're here on a Saturday. And if you are a New Yorker or you go to New York and you have never been to their farm, you've got to check it out. They're in Old Brookville from Young's Farm. I have Tim and Aiden on the line. So welcome to the show.
Hi,
Tim and
how are
Aiden.
You been, Jackie?
Thanks for having us.
Well, thank you so much for both of you being here. So go ahead and tell listeners a little bit about yourselves and your farm and your story. I'll be quiet.
So Young's Farm is a family farm. It's been in the same location since 1892. I work with my wife, and my mother-in-law is the owner. We are generation five now running the farm, and it has evolved in many various ways. It was a dairy farm, and then was farming for wholesale in New York City for a while. And then around the time when my mother-in-law was in her mid-20s, they started selling things locally as the kind of community built here around them. And now we have a full store on site. So we have a bakery here, a gift shop as well, and then our produce and also some prepared food items that we do with our produce when in season and also the rest of the year. We're open February to Christmas. We currently are farming about 15 acres altogether. We're in our third year of farming organically. We are not certified organic. About 10 of those acres are in production and 5 are in cover crop. And that's where we are right now. We grow a really wide variety of crops, kind of trying to simulate what you can get in a grocery store. And that's kind of our current state. Aiden, you want to give your background a little?
Sure. So this is, I'm going on my third year as the farm manager here, and I'm new to Long Island, but it's where my fiance is from. And I was just excited for the opportunity to work for this farm because it's well established and it's such a fixture in the community. And I've just been part of the team as we transition to organic production.
Awesome. Well, I have a million questions to ask. And one of the things I don't want to forget to bring up, we don't have to go there right now, but I saw on your website that you bring in things from other farms too. So you're not just selling. And so I think because a lot of my listeners are green future growers, I call them, like, they are gardeners, but maybe they have businesses. They're very environmentally focused. They have green businesses, or they work for a green business or a nonprofit, or they're an educator, like in the sciences and botany or gardening or horticulture. And just, I think they're going to be interested about that kind of business model where, you know,
bringing that cooperation, selling other farm, like nobody's mentioned that. And I saw that in there and I thought, oh, what a great idea to have a market. And then that enables you to have your market at your farm. You're not having to deal with going to other farmers' markets or going, like you said, and you talked about it, it said that you used to be a wholesaler and now mostly you're just a retailer. So I think that's going to be awesome. But I always start the show talking about your first garden experience. Now, I'm not the best when I have two guests on the line at the same time, but I will try to like preface who's talking, or maybe if you want to say, because it does get confusing when you have two male voices, who's Tim and who's Aiden. So just maybe if you can start being like, I'm Tim and this is my first gardening experience. Like, were you a kid? Were you an adult? Like, now, Tim, it's your mother-in-law's. And did you say you didn't grow up in New York? Like, I don't know. But you maybe that was your first gardening experience where you grew up.
My first gardening experience or gardening memory is actually my grandfather's entire backyard, was a garden, effectively. So that's really my first memories are actually, as a small child, playing back there with oversized zucchini and throwing them in the pond to the fish and stuff like that. So that was really my first, exposure to it. And then eating, obviously, the vegetables that he grew right from the ground. I didn't immediately go into farming in any way after that, but that was certainly my first experience with it.
Yeah, and my first experience was definitely when I was really young also. Both of my parents were avid gardeners, and my father ended up having like a little bit of a homestead where he raised animals and things like that. And then as an adult, I guess I got into agriculture by way of working in landscaping and tree services. And yeah, that just naturally, it just piqued my interest in agriculture. And I ended up going to college for it at Sterling College in Vermont. And I started working on farms up there and then in the Hudson Valley. And now I'm farming on Long Island.
Awesome. I just talked to, and I haven't posted this episode yet. I can't wait to post it. This guy, Larry C., I think it's his name. It's like TSE from this restaurant called, I want to say it's called Diggin, that they have like in Boston, and there's some in New York City, but he's their farm manager and their farm is in the Hudson Valley. So now how did you start working on these farms? Like, were you woofing it or just like through college, like an internship, or you actually got paid like a summer job?
Yeah, well, my first farm job was actually as part of an internship that was part of my college curriculum. Every agriculture major was required to, apprentice on a farm. And that farm was, they focused on grass-fed beef and raw milk dairy and also vegetables, like value-added vegetable products. He was making kimchi and sauerkraut. And then from there, I worked on a variety of different farms, ranging from like livestock-oriented to, garden variety vegetables. And it's been like a gradual but steady process of just having me focus more and more on vegetables as I keep doing this. So now I don't even think about animals.
Interesting. Well, I didn't really think about animals till I started my podcast and just kind of thought it was about vegetables. But I've learned that, there's a lot of different pieces out there, and especially we talk a lot about landscaping and lawns and how having an organic lawn is so important because that's where your pets are playing, that's where your kids are learning to crawl, and they have smaller bodies, so those same chemicals are going into their bodies a little bit more intensely than an adult body. So and that all came about from paying attention to my podcast, because my mom didn't use chemicals, but our neighbor sure did, and just it's like, we don't use them at my house. So it didn't really occur to me as much. So anyway, I'm totally off topic here. Do you want to talk about like, why did Young's Farm, maybe Tim, this is more your thing, but like what made you change to going organic 3 years ago and how's that going? Not being certified organic is no big deal at all to us.
Sure. I can speak to that a bit. Prior to Aiden being here, we had an prior to my being here as well, there was a farm manager here named Charlie who had worked here for 40 years. So he, the system was pretty established here as a conventional farm. And unfortunately, he got sick. He ended up getting cancer and kind of and passed away. We knew he was sick, but we didn't expect him to pass away quite when he did. What we did kind of learn in that process was, you know, as his health was declining, he was the primary applicator of pesticides and herbicides and that type of thing. Less and less of those were applied just because he wasn't physically up to it. And we didn't see really a dramatic change in yield in terms of what we were getting in the stand to sell. So after he passed away, we were looking to go in a different direction. You know, many customers asked if we were farming organically, if we're certified organic, and we said, well, if we're not really getting any benefit from conventional farming, what's the point of doing it that way still? And so for he passed away in, I guess, late March, 3 years ago or so, 3 years ago, almost exactly. Mm-hmm. And after that, we began looking for a farm manager, and we didn't bring on Aiden until the following year. So we had kind of a transitional period, which we just weren't really spraying at all for the balance of that year. But we still were using treated seeds at that point and that type of thing, because the seed orders already occurred. And as for the transition since then, I think there has been a learning curve, but you know, we haven't seen anything, you know, fall off the cliff in terms of production. And I think we've actually increased quality in many areas. And I think the most important thing that we certainly became neglected as Charlie's health was deteriorating was just the soil itself. In terms of soil maintenance and soil quality, the appropriate cover crops and manures we would typically apply that were kind of being lost in the shuffle. But now we are certainly much more conscious of that and rotating much more carefully and focusing on our soil much more.
My gosh, this is so interesting. You guys have been dropping golden seeds like crazy. That's what I call, like, some podcasts call them golden nuggets. I call them golden seeds. And who knew? I had no idea you were going to talk about any of this today.
Yeah. I also, you know, we weren't necessarily a place that, as most farms on the island are, you know, most farms, the scale is quite small. So even if a farm is conventional, unless it's really mechanized and organized at scale, you know, they're spraying when absolutely necessary only. It's not like, you know, an everyday application. I mean, an every week application, you know, systematically, mostly for economics more than anything else. You know, I mean, that's what I've, in talking to other farmers that grow on the island, you know, it just, for the scale people are at and the money they're making, that it's just not that financially feasible to spray with super, you know, regularity. So, which is, you know, we, as you mentioned earlier, we do buy from other farms and, you know, we are considerate of that as well. We certainly buy from many conventional farms, but, you know, we know the farmers personally and know, you know, their general growing practices and are comfortable with that.
Cool. I like all of this. So, do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year?
Sure, Aiden, why don't you handle that one?
Okay. Well, let's see. Tomatoes are a huge crop for us. It would be hard to imagine this farm stand without tomatoes. So we changed the way we're growing tomatoes. We're continually changing the way we grow tomatoes to kind of have like a nice succession, like a stable supply of tomatoes, because I think one thing that a lot of gardeners can relate to is, you know, when peak tomato hits, you've got tons of them and a lot ends up going to waste. If you're, you know, like we couldn't even possibly turn all of our surplus into sauce if we tried. So one focus of ours has just been, you know, increasing the quality of tomatoes and making sure that we have a stable supply throughout the whole year instead of that bell curve peak in August where you're just drowning in tomatoes, you know. And also, yeah, we've been doing that a couple different ways. We're using caterpillar tunnels. I don't know if you're familiar with those, but they're more or less just like mobile greenhouses or mobile high tunnels that are relatively simple to set up, and you can move them according to your crop rotation. So we've been using those to plant, you know, different varieties of tomatoes at different times of the year. And yeah, we've been having great success with that. And yeah, we're also just growing indeterminate heirloom tomatoes in like more of a traditional greenhouse with traditional methods of, you know, pruning to a single or double stem and, you know, training them up a string all the way up the ceiling.
Yep. So I got a couple of questions. Like, you said that you're spreading your thing out so that your goal is like that you have tomatoes a steady supply. Like, do you have tomatoes now in February? Like, you got or March, the end of March? You got snow this morning, right?
My mom so said we don't have tomatoes now. But the idea is that, you know, if you were just to go out and plant, most people do one plantings of tomatoes, a lot of small. And if we were to do that, we would just have a huge surplus of tomatoes in for just a few weeks in August, really. So instead, what we're doing is we're planting smaller amounts starting, you know, a few weeks ago is when we started them in the greenhouse. And those will be transplanted in April in like 3 weeks or so. And those will be tomatoes, hopefully, you know, right in time for 4th of July period. And the idea is to have, you know, we don't want to be harvesting things that just end up in the compost. So it's just finding that balance of having enough, but not too much, and a constant supply instead of just, you know, a huge amount of them at once. And then quality wise with the tomatoes, we've been, you know, just working on our fertilizer regimen, and just trying to get better quality fruit. And that can be said for all the crops, but it's nice to focus on the tomatoes because you can really hone in on, you know, the fertility regimen with those.
What do you do for a fertility regimen?
I would say that it's compost based, but in addition to that, we use, you know, at transplant, we plant them with kelp meal and feather meal. And, you know, the kelp meal is just to cover all the trace minerals. And the feather meal is a source of nitrogen to get them up to flowering, really. And then once we do a couple foliar sprays at first flowering, that's like a seaweed-based foliar. And then once fruit set occurs, we increase the potassium because, you know, that potassium is important to fruiting crops. And, we do that with an organic sulfate of potash product. It's just one thing that I think a lot of tomato growers can do is over-fertilize nitrogen, and you end up getting these, you know, beautiful tropical-looking green plants, but they kind of peter out when it comes to fruit production, because nitrogen typically feeds, you know, green plants, the chlorophyll. You know, chlorophyll is nitrogen-based. So, you know, lighter-feeding crops, contrary to what most people think, actually have higher nitrogen requirements than other crops, you know, like bigger crops like squash or tomatoes. Like something like lettuce might have a higher nitrogen requirement.
Wow, awesome. I don't know if anybody, if they have, I've forgotten, has gone into such detail on like how to get your tomatoes to produce more fruit. This is excellent. Thank you so much for sharing with us today. So how about something you're excited to try next year that's new or different there that you haven't done before? Or is that the tomato? Oh, I didn't mean to ask. Like, so are they called caterpillar tunnels because they keep the caterpillars out?
No, so it's picture a high tunnel greenhouse that is, it kind of ends up looking like a caterpillar because it's like a round Quonset shape, but the plastic, the greenhouse plastic, is held onto the bows with a rope, and it ends up kind of just making the plastic look like a segmented caterpillar. So the tunnel itself looks like a tunnel, like a caterpillar. But for those tomato hornworms, I'd say that it does help a little bit that they're in the tunnel. One thing though, this is another gardening tip. So those tomato hornworms, they come from a nocturnal moth. That's how they end up on your plant. So it, whether they're in a tunnel or outside, if you can cover the plants up at nighttime, they're not going to be able to lay eggs on your plants. And that's where the hornworm comes from. So it's just a little tip. So some growers, if they're growing in high tunnels, they'll actually just roll down the sides every, you know, they'll close up the greenhouse at nighttime so that they won't have any hornworm issues.
They probably, the tomato plants probably like that too, because it keeps the heat in, and they like heat, right? Especially at night, like in a colder place like Montana where it gets really cold. Well, cool. I'm glad I asked that, because I'll bet some other listeners out there were probably thinking like I was about it was to get rid of the caterpillars more than that it looks like a tomato. But it sounds like it kind of helps get rid of, keep the caterpillar, the moths
it's
off.
It's mostly just to keep the rain off of them, because here we're in a really humid climate here, much more humid than where you are, and we can get them.
So we can get all
types of foliar diseases associated with just rain on the leaves. So that's the main reason for growing it.
So the other, just to chime in for a second, thing that you know, the caterpillar tunnels help with in general. You know, we're trying to focus more on season extension now, and having because we are a business and obviously trying to offer more to our customers throughout the year. We have a bakery and the obviously the farm side of the business. It's really two different customer bases. Obviously, we do the best when everybody's shopping. So the more produce we can offer for the longer window in the year, we can keep those vegetable shoppers around. And that's part of the reason that we're, you know, investing in things like those tunnels to help have tomatoes a little earlier and a little later, and as well as some other crops as well.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Tim, for adding that, because I, like I said, my listeners are really interested in these kind of things. Like, I was just looking at the top 10 and top 20 downloads this month, or since January, basically. And one of them was this woman that came on that talks about the cottage food bill in Montana that we just got passed. But I know there's, I think a bill went through in New York, very similar, and they're like around the country. And they talk about exactly what we were talking about, how to help farmers have value added products to extend their seasons so they can have successful businesses, because ultimately, you know, that's one of the things we need in our country are good jobs, you know, quality paying jobs, and running a quality paying business enables you to hire people like Aiden and let him make a decent wage, and other people have decent jobs doing things that they like. And so, you know, any kind of tips like that is, I know my listeners are very interested in. So, and also like talk just in general, people having choices to buy locally grown vegetables. You know, that's a big part of my podcast too, having access, like even if they don't garden as much, just being able to find places where they can get locally grown food. How about something you're excited to do different next year or want to try that's new?
Well, I'll just piggyback on what Tim was saying about season extension. So we're going to have a lot more room for winter growing. So, we're going to be growing a lot more winter spinach and a few other crops like arugula and, you know, a salad mix, a greens mix. But I just have to say, in general, for as another gardening tip, spinach is hands down the best and the most hardy winter growing green. And if you can get spinach established in the fall, it can overwinter even without a greenhouse in a lot of climates. The greenhouse just really helps with like the leaf quality, or you know, the aesthetics of the leaf, really. So we're definitely going to be experimenting more with winter growing in general. And if I had to say one crop, probably spinach.
Cool. I have so many things I can add about that. For one, I am like so in love with arugula, because I went to Paris 2 years ago to celebrate my first 100,000 downloads of the Organic Gardener podcast, and the very first day. So you get to Paris, and it's early morning, but you can't really check into your hotel till later. And so I went to see the Eiffel Tower, of course, and found myself like going to get a cup of coffee and breakfast at this one restaurant. And they served me two eggs and a side salad of arugula. And it was just this itty bitty baby arugula. And I am so in love with arugula. Like every time I taste it, it reminds me of my meal in Paris that first morning there, right before I saw the Eiffel Tower. And I have arugula coming up in my windowsill in my apartment where I stay during the week where I teach. That I just look, because I just posted it today. My student planted February 26th for me. And by March 4th, it was sprouted. By March 15th, I could start picking leaves, like itty bitty tiny ones that are like the size of my pinky. But you put six of those little tiny things on a sandwich, and it gives you that flavor. And so I'm just so much more in love with arugula than I ever was. And then I just looked down, like I planted a fall garden, which for me to plant a fall garden, I think I actually planted it July 26th last year, I want to say. And then I was eating from it in the spring. I mean, in the fall, like in September. So I think I planted it at the end of July. It was coming up in September. And a lot of it, I picked arugula at Thanksgiving out there coming up through the snow. And I just went and looked yesterday. So we're talking Saturday, March 24th. And there's something coming up down there where I planted, I don't know if it's arugula or salad greens or whatever I planted in that fall thing, is already sprouting here, where it's so funny because there's still snow everywhere, but then there's a lot of brown spots. And that's coming up. So just a little side note, listeners, about what's going on here in Montana. But spinach is definitely good to know. I've had spinach come up through the snow in Montana in the spring before that we planted in the fall. So so do you have spinach like that you can eat right now? Because there's actually a woman in Montana who's selling kale that she grew indoors this winter.
Yeah, she has we have some out in the field that will be ready really soon. And then we spinach and arugula and baby kale were the first direct seeded crops that we seeded in greenhouses this spring. And they're going to be ready in, you know, 1 or 2 weeks.
Yeah. Cool. How about something that didn't work last season that didn't turn out the way you thought it was going to, or didn't work so well?
I'd say one... it's definitely a learning curve. Like, I wouldn't call it a complete failure, but we were trying to use more plastic mulches. And, you know, when you're farming on our scale, they're really useful for growing certain crops like tomatoes and things. And you'd think that would make weed control easier, but I'm relatively new to using them. And it actually made weed control pretty difficult, like on the edges of the plastic. And, you know, it's just something that I don't want to rely on, you know, using one-time plastics like that. So in general, I'd say that was probably the biggest failure, was just using more crops, or using plastic mulch on more crops, which is something I'm just going to try to stay away from in the future.
So what are you going to try to use this year instead?
More or less just cultivating on some crops. We're not really equipped to use like a straw mulch, and, you know, stuff like straw is really expensive here, compared to where you are, I'm sure. But
We were just talking about this because last year Mike got a killer deal of 50 bales for $100. And already this year, those same 50 bales from that same place it's $150. It's $3 a bale. And Mike has like what I call like the mini farm that he planted. But you guys, what'd you say? It was a 15 acres or was it bigger?
10 acres of vegetable crops.
Yeah, that's a lot.
I think we'd probably be paying more like $5 a bale.
Yep.
And then, you know, you kind of get into the same dilemmas though if you're trying to farm organically, where there's a good chance that herbicide was used to produce that straw and it could have all types of weed seeds in it and stuff. So, you know, that's something that's just not really available for us to use, you know. So, you know, one other thing we've been experimenting with though that's similar is using like living mulches. So we plant annual ryegrass in between our tomatoes. And that ends up just looking like a green lawn grass that grows really quickly. And it's just the type of thing that you can mow for weed suppression instead of, you know, having bare dirt that you have to cultivate over and over again.
I was just going to ask that about cover crops. So there was the answer right before I said that. Because we're just really, really learning about growing green cover crops and planting. Before we get to the root of things, we're going to thank our sponsors and affiliate links. freegardencourse.com. Mike and I have developed some lessons to help you create your very own organic oasis. We'll guide you through the steps to build your perfect natural landscape, an edible earth-friendly yard, a sustainable deep-bed garden, or even start a small profitable market farm. We'll show you how to save time, lower your produce bill, collect usable data, eat healthy, nutritious food with minimal labor, use the most effective and efficient production methods currently being used in backyard gardens as well as market farms, and maybe even help you find some profitable markets. We've designed it to save you time, lower your produce bill, and help you eat healthy, nutritious food. There's checklists, there's outside reading, video assignments. You can join the online Facebook community where there's lots of people from around the world to help you get your garden started today. So remember, freegardencourse.com.
This is Robin Kelson from the Good Seed Company. We sell heirloom seeds for common use. We offer vegetable, herb, flower seeds locally adapted for our area, and all open pollinated and heirloom, a lot of them organic or ecologically farmed. We also sell seed collections to help you, to help new gardeners be successful in their growing. We sell flower collections that are good for pollinators. We sell medicinal herbs and culinary herbs, all sorts of seeds that would be of interest to new and experienced gardeners. www.goodseedco.net.
So this is actually where we get to, like, what I call getting to the root of things. And these are kind of quicker questions, but maybe you guys each want to share, like, Tim, do you have like a least favorite activity to do? Do you help in the garden, Tim, or do you just run the farm? You help, right? And do a lot of the farming.
Me part, personally?
Too,
right?
Or do you?
No.
I don't know. Yeah. So, well, you just run the business thing.
I'm not working much on the farm. In case of emergency, break glass kind of situations is when Tim comes to help. But in theory, if everyone shows up and is doing what they're supposed to be doing, then I'm not typically involved on a day-to-day basis. But certainly in crop planning and long-term planning and that type of thing.
Okay. But do you have a least favorite activity to do then when you have to show up? That you're like, don't call me for this job.
I would say I haven't had to do this in the past year, but my least favorite thing is picking up plastic that you've used to for mulch. So fortunately, I have not had that responsibility this year, but historically, that's my least favorite job.
All right. And, you know, as a shout out to, like, there was this big video on Facebook this week that Mike was showing me about the people swimming through the, like, I guess there's a thing of plastic in the ocean that's the size of two Texases. And they showed these people, like, actually swimming through the water with all the plastic and, like, a stingray and these different fish that are living there and how much plastic's there. So I think finding another thing besides plastic mulch, there's another reason why. How about you, Aiden? What's your least favorite activity?
I got a couple. Okay. I'd say maybe, I don't know, just any task that involves fighting the wind. Because a lot of times, whether it's like a greenhouse film that's like, you know, come loose, or row cover, you know, like an insect netting row cover or anything. Anytime you're fighting the wind, it's pretty miserable. And then other than that, you know, maybe fixing irrigation leaks, you know, just running around and finding leaks in the irrigation lines and stuff like that.
What do you do to fix an irrigation leak? Do you tape it shut, or like you have
fitting.
To
There's all types of fittings. Normally what I end up using is kind of like it's almost like a little pipe piece that you can put inside of a hose. And then there are these clamps that look like radiator clamps, like what you see, you know, if you lift up the hood on your car, you see all those little metal brackets. It's like those ones.
Yeah, those are tricky to deal with. So on the flip side, what are your favorite activities to do in the garden? Like, Tim, when you're sitting there going, man, I'm sick of doing the accounting and like this plan didn't go out well, what I wish Aiden would call me and say, come do this in the garden.
I am called to harvest when Aiden's not around or staff is not around. And I do like that. I particularly like harvesting some of the root crops. I like bunching beets and carrots for me personally. So.
Cool. How about you, Aiden?
Well, I love when I'm cultivating, when I'm using the tractor to cultivate the weeds. I just love seeing that work well. That can be really satisfying. And also, you know, just, yeah, like having like a really great harvest, regardless of the crop, when it's, you know, weed free and the crop looks great, that's really satisfying to see.
Cool. How about the best gardening advice you've ever received?
For me, I would, you know, I spoke after our old farm manager, Charlie, had passed away. I spoke to kind of a wide variety of people about where the farm could go and how it could change. And the most critical thing for me, and I don't really have like a super perfect quote, but to paraphrase, is that, you know, we should really be focused on improving the soil and growing good soil, and if we can achieve that, then you know, our plants will be, you know, working great on their own, and you won't have to be dealing with as many issues. And I think changing that focus for the farm was critical. And I, you know, since that point, you know, I've been much more involved in, you know, the process of where the farm's going, what our philosophy is. So, and that's been really a key point for me.
I love that. That's so awesome. And I'm hoping to put this episode up for Mother's Day. And what a perfect shout out for Mother Earth. And definitely healthy soil is like by far the biggest key or takeaway from my show. It all starts with healthy soil.
Aiden?
Yeah. I'd say the best gardening advice would be, just in general, just kind of simplifying all the processes. I know that gardeners, they get really passionate about what they want to do, but I think as a side effect of that, they end up overcomplicating a lot of things. So I would say just kind of like keeping it simple and just having like processes at work that, as Tim alluded, are more just based around the health of the soil. So, you know, using compost and using tarps, that's actually been like a huge help for us, and I think it can be a huge help for small-scale gardeners, is just covering the soil with tarps as a way to manage weeds and to protect the soil from, you know, the wind and the rain and everything.
Erosion.
Yeah. So, yeah, and maybe just having, like, your irrigation figured out, you know, all that stuff.
Awesome. These are excellent tips. And the other thing I was going to say about what you said, Tim, is I love the way you went and asked other people when you were trying to decide the steps for the farm and where it should go and what your future was going to be like, because so many people talk about, you know, that's the best thing you can do is ask other people, get feedback, and then kind of put it together in your own way, what's best for you. So another great business tip for my listeners. So how about a favorite tool? Like if you had to move and start all over, what tool could you not live without? Or Aiden, what tool did you not want to come to the farm without? Or maybe you found something since you've been there. I don't know.
Since I came here, this working as a farm manager here has definitely been, it's more of like a mechanized vegetable farm than I'd ever worked at. So like the whole process of getting acquainted with and familiar with all the different tractor tillage implements and everything was a little daunting. So I have to say my favorite tool is definitely the spader, which is, the spader is what we use for our primary tillage. And whenever we're, you know, putting a cover crop under and to plant a cash crop or anything like that, we use the spader. And more or less what that does is it has these big shovels, these big scoops that rotate on an axis to invert the soil, but it does it really in a really gentle way. So it, you know, it's one of the more gentle forms of tillage you can have. It doesn't break apart all the aggregates in the soil, and it really makes cover cropping a lot easier of a process on our farm. So yeah, it simplifies. It's just an all around great tool.
Just to jump on that quickly, before we had hired Aiden, we used to plow very regularly, which creates what's called like a plow plate. I'm not sure if you've heard of that before, but at the depth of where your plow plows, there becomes like a hard surface where roots cannot easily penetrate.
That makes sense.
The spader does not have that issue and allows the soil to kind of keep its natural biodiversity happening in a much better way than a typical plow would.
Excellent. The first time I heard of no-till agriculture, John Moore was on my show, and it was like episode 13 or 17 or something, and I was so nervous just making sure, just like I'm sitting here now and going back and forth, and are we still recording? Are we still recording? And like at the very end, I'm like, well, do you have a final tip? And he's like, yeah, no dig. And I'm like, wait, did you just say no dig? And he's like, I've been talking about this for like a half hour now, Jackie. But he just like explained it again because it was so new to me. Like I had never heard of that till I started my process that like, you know, that you really have to care about your soil and how much you're digging it up and disturbing the biodiversity, like you said, and the nutrients and the microorganisms that are down there. So a spader is still some kind of mechanical tool with a bunch of shovel. Like I was just totally picturing, I wish I could play this for my fourth grade students because we constantly talk about our comprehension strategy this week is visualizing, and I was totally visualizing it while you were speaking. I'm not sure I still have 100%. Hopefully we can see a picture or something, put a picture in the show notes, but I think listeners are going to enjoy that learning something.
If you can compare it to a rototiller, where a rototiller has all those tines, kind of just, you know, scoop through the soil and really pulverize it, where this has bigger, shovel looking things that actually go slower. And instead of pulverizing the soil into like a homogeneous mix, it really just flips it. So that's the big difference. And yeah, I think there's a lot of really great things to be said for no-till operations, but I have yet to see, particularly in our climate where, you know, the soil has to be warmed up, I've yet to see anybody doing it on our scale. Because like once you get past an acre or an acre and a half, a lot of things have to be mechanized, and crops do need loose soil. It doesn't have to be tilled for sure, but they definitely need a loose soil. Yeah. So like on the garden scale, people will use a broad fork and just amend with compost. But for us, that's not really feasible. And if we want a cover crop, we have to terminate that cover crop. Otherwise,
Oh yeah, that was the other thing I was gonna say, is that I read this awesome book by this woman, Anna Hess, wrote like a little primer on cover crops, and that's the biggest thing she talks about is the different ways to kill them and planting ones that are the easiest to kill and how you're gonna turn them in, and there's different depending on the season and when you're planting it and the killing it. So I like the way you were talking about that too.
I mean, I would say cool. I agree with what Aiden was saying with the no-till thing. I mean, for a garden scale, it certainly is something that's probably worth experimenting with on a small level. I would say, from my understanding, it certainly seems to be the leading edge of organic agriculture as in terms of soil development without the use of amendments or with minimal use of amendments. How feasible it is there's obviously challenges associated with it, but if you're willing to experiment and have a little space to mess around with, I would say go for it.
I don't know if anybody's talked about doing it on I don't think anybody on my show has for sure.
I guess the classic form of large scale no-till would be like conventional corn and soybeans, but as we all know, that's really dependent on the use of herbicides and also tillage. They still like do like a subsoiling every other year. So, it's just the type of thing. Mm-hmm. Planting annual vegetables usually require some type of like annual disturbance, or like something approximating it.
How about if favorite recipe you like to cook or eat from the garden?
For me, not to steal your arugula thunder, Jackie, but I love just arugula with olive oil and lemon and a little Parmesan. You know, just can't be beat. It's pretty strong and just delicious representation of high quality arugula for me.
Yeah, for me, sure. I'll do another simple one. We grow a fair amount of shishito peppers. I don't know if you've tried them or if any of your listeners have tried them.
No, shishito, how do you spell that?
S-H-I-S-H-I-T-O.
Or no,
shishito
no,
pepper.
Yeah, pepper. It's like a little, it's like a little green pepper, sorry, like the size of your index finger. And they're delicious. They're kind of similar to a padrone. But all I do with them is I put them in a cast iron skillet with some olive oil or butter at a pretty high heat and blister them and put sea salt on them, and they're delicious. They're not very spicy, but just a really good flavor.
So they're actually, this is Tim, they're actually rarely hot. So it's like 1 in 20 is spicy, and most taste like, a, you know, in the range of a bell pepper. But it's a Japanese item, as you might be able to guess from the name, but.
Like, is there somewhere, like, where did you meet all those farmers from, Tim, that you were asking questions? Like, just locally people in your neighborhood? Or, like, did you find them online?
Yeah, I don't know where internet, that was from. Definitely not internet-based, but to quickly go over that. So, as you alluded to way earlier in the podcast, we do buy things from other farms. So, we develop relationships with farmers, and that was really my responsibility. I started a lot of those when I came to the farm. And at that point, Charlie, the farmer, was still, you know, basically, he had the, you know, the system under control, you know, and I wasn't involved as directly with the farm itself. So after he passed away, I reached out to those people that I knew and said, you know, who do you think I should talk to? Who do you suggest we reach out to? Blah, blah, blah. And that's kind of, so most people I spoke to post fact were really Long Island based. And then a few, you know, also in the greater New York, New England area, but nothing really beyond that. In terms of an internet resource, I have to give Aiden credit for this. He turned me on to the Farmer to Farmer podcast, which I guess is your competitor in some way, but really more professionally tilted than your podcast, I think. But
no, I had Chris Blanchard on. We're the more farm and gardening podcasts out there, the better. He's definitely not my competition. He's just another podcaster out there talking about, and like you said, he's definitely more focused on people who are professional gardeners who are making their living.
Yeah,
I think right?
Absolutely. And but I mean, I, you know, if you're really into the nuts and bolts of how and why things are going and different strategies, it's an amazing resource and really has opened my eyes to, you know, many more different ways to approach farming. Not that it's dramatically changed what we do, but it's just really good to stay open minded and keep progressing forward. You know.
Cool.
Yeah, and for me, I definitely listen to the Farmer to Farmer podcast every week. And as far as this one's kind of online, it's like it's a magazine, but they also have online resources. But it'd be Growing for Market magazine. Yeah, they're awesome.
Yeah.
They've got like an online database, and you can search it just by topic. So if you wanted to search, you know, greenhouse tomatoes or spinach or anything, you can just plug in that word and find whatever past articles they have written on that topic.
And I could be wrong, but I want to say that Growing for Market is Lynn Bazankian, right? Who wrote?
She started it, but I guess she handed it over to this guy Andrew Mefford. I want to say his name is, and he was one of the greenhouse trialists, greenhouse researchers at Johnny's Selected Seeds, and he just wrote a new book on greenhouse production in general. But yeah, he's the new manager of it as of maybe last year.
Yeah, because I loved her book, The Flower Farmer. Like, I was like, I'm going to be a flower farmer. And I followed a lot of the things. And that's when I was like, my first goal, my first year of starting my podcast, I was like, I'm going to plant 750 sunflowers. And I did it. And then I talked to Lisa Ziegler, who grows flowers on Virginia. And she's like, yeah, we plant like 1,000 sunflowers a week, plus like zillions of other flowers. She's like, you need to plant like 750 sunflowers a week for 26 weeks. If you're going to try to go sunflowers for market. And I haven't gotten anywhere near that, but, yeah. And so, but I've definitely followed Growing for Market, or I'm pretty sure I get their email, but I didn't know about that change there. Yeah. How about a favorite? Wait, we did an internet resource. Where did I put that on the wrong question? How about a favorite reading book or magazine or blog or website or something to recommend?
I have to give Aiden credit for this too. The Lean Farm book is very good about applying lean management techniques to the farm. That's something that I really got a lot of good insight from, and we're still looking to apply a lot of that insight. We're certainly not there, but that's a very compelling and interesting way to go about management. I mean, management also, you know, we have a lot of other staff besides Aiden here, better or worse. There's about 20 other people here on a regular basis, cooking and selling and cleaning and everything else. So management is something that's on my mind a lot.
Yeah. And that's tough, whether you're managing a classroom of students like I try to every day or managing adults. Like, it's all there's a definite thing to master there, or a skill, or like lots of cool things to to deal with there. Yeah. How about you, Aiden?
Oh, man, I have so many farm books. But if I had to pick maybe just a couple that are relevant to vegetable production and gardening in particular, I would, well, definitely say any of Elliot Coleman's books, and maybe The Market Gardener by Jean-Martin Fortier, and the John Jevons book. I think it's called like Grow More Vegetables by John Jevons. Any of those, because those are like, they have everything in there, whether, you know, kind of like, whether it's crop spacing or fertility regimens, or, you know, varieties to use and all the techniques. Those books are like very comprehensive, and I think a lot of people would find them to be really helpful.
One other internet resource, just quickly, that's really good. If you look up Roxbury Farm, which is in the Hudson Valley, they have, if you're looking for the nitty gritty on how to plant row crops in specific detail, at what spacing, at what time intervals, how we do weed control, they have extraordinarily large amount of information available just on their website for anyone to look up. So that might be interesting for some of your readers or listeners, excuse me.
Nice. Well, cool. How about some business advice for listeners on either how to get started selling extra produce, or get started in the industry, or any challenge? Or you guys are just been full of anything you want to say. I know listeners are going to love.
I would say, I mean, we are very fortunate that we are one of the last farms in our county, and really surrounded by this very densely relatively well off to do area, densely populated, well off to do area. So we have a very nice market around us immediately, you know, willing to come and shop and buy our vegetables. If you have extra produce or looking to get started in the industry, I would think the first thing you need to consider is the market, though, and then where you can actually market those things. And don't, you know, don't go further than that. Don't hurt yourself. You know, I think it's as when you figure out that I'm going to have a place to sell this somehow, some way, start with that. That'll be my advice.
Yeah. My advice for someone starting off would be, you know, after having your market figured out, would be having some self-control when you're in front of the seed catalog.
And instead of trying to grow two varieties of every single crop in there, starting off at least, I would like really recommend on doing 10 or less crops and trying to really figure out how to grow them really well. And then from there, you can even, you know, edit, or you could take away crops and add crops based on which ones you're doing well and which ones you make money on. But if you can, that's just one way to really simplify things and have a constant supply of things that would make your life easier.
I just got to ask you, Aiden, like, if somebody's like graduating high school and they're thinking about going to college, but they want to become a market farmer, like, would you say go to college and go that route? Or would you say just go get an internship? Like, how did you, like, if their dreams to become, I mean, a farm manager, like, what steps would you recommend the most, or where would you?
Well, I would, realistically, I would ask them whether they're going to have to pay for their college themselves, you know, because if you are going to have to pay for it out of pocket, I think that you can really get a quality farming education through working on farms if you do it at the right farms. Because, you know, if you're taking part in a legitimate internship, part of the deal is, or, you know, as an apprentice, part of that deal is that you're not only, you know, maybe getting a stipend, but you're also getting quality education. And that's definitely where you're going to get the most hands-on experience. And then, you know, beyond that, there's tons of, you know, resources in the ways of books and things. But I think the hardest part is just to kind of get, you know, kind of just be keyed into the agriculture community somehow. You know, like, that's really where I think all the education happens, is when all of a sudden you're not an outsider looking in, but you're just part of the farming community. And once you're in that community, people are really eager and willing to share their experiences with you. And that's something that I've found to be true more so with farmers than any other trade. Like, it seems like if you're talking to like plumbers or carpenters, they want to be very elusive and not tell you how to do things. But if you're talking to farmers, they're just really excited to talk to another farmer, and they want to share all their knowledge with you, which is great.
I think it's because it is hard work. And if you're that interested and you're willing, they're going to know right away if you're willing to put in that hard work, and then they're willing to share. And they, you know, I think that has a little bit to do with it maybe. And it's just a passion that people would want to, you know, like I said, it's not really competition. Like, a farmer's market's not going to succeed if there's only one farm there. Like, you need that community out there to make people come. Or people shop. I don't know.
Just to follow up on Aiden's point about, or your question of education, that I think that, you know, as a manager or a hirer, an employee, I think, you know,
yeah,
someone who did go to school for it, that is a differentiator when we're hiring, for sure. But that being said, I did not go to school for farming in any way, shape, sense, or form, nor did I work in any way with it leading up to my time here. I graduated from college with a degree in film and studio art, and then I worked in real estate, and then I got married, and my wife's family ran a farm, so that's how I got here. But I think Aiden's point is true very much, that the farming community is very open and typically willing to share. I think that particularly in the Northeast, there's a kindred spirit feeling, because there aren't as many farms necessarily as there once was, and it's less about competition and more about keeping the farms that are here. And the final kind of tack on point is that in terms of resources, I think the amount of material available on the internet is just grown exponentially. I mean, this is my seventh year now, and I think it's just so different from where it was when I started, just in terms of what you can find on YouTube and Instagram and all these other websites and resources that we've spoken about. But there's plenty of opportunity for education in either way. I still think there's benefit. If you can, as Aiden said, if you can afford it and have the time, there's certainly benefits to a traditional education as well.
Yeah, and I'll add on a little bit, because I don't want to make it seem like I was coming down too hard on college. I will say that having like a formal education, like some background and some of the more technical things like soil sciences and plant sciences is really, really helpful. But for the actual farming techniques, I would say that there is like at least a 10-year lag behind what farmers are doing and what like all like the land grant universities are doing. As far, like particularly with organics, I think, because I think a lot of those bigger universities are more focused on conventional production. So there's like a bit of a lag there between what the cutting edge organic producers are doing and what the universities are teaching as far as like organic crop production. But the more like formal science backgrounds is really helpful, and it's hard to, maybe it's just like a discipline thing, but it's hard to learn that just through internet and books if you're not, you know, forced to be in a classroom.
Excellent. Those are all great tips. And I think listeners are going to find, you know, whatever they're looking for, if they're thinking of going to college or if they're just like, oh my gosh, yeah, don't make me sit in a classroom for two more seconds. You know, that will give them some feedback. Okay. So here's my final question. It's kind of a doozy. If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale? And I guess,
sure,
Tim, are you going to
go first? I'm not sure this is a global scale issue. It probably is in a lot of places. And it's something that I would like to see implemented more locally here for sure. I know it happens on the West Coast. Not sure it happens for you, but in terms of a community-based composting system, which does not exist here, in terms of food waste being turned into compost, I think that I would like, you know, there's many, many people living on Long Island, and I know all of that is just mixed in with the regular trash. And that's something that I would think, you know, I'm not trying to do it tomorrow here at the farm, but I'd like to spearhead that with our farm itself and being able to take them from people and produce, you know, we buy lots of compost. I'd love to produce more. I'd love to be able to, you know, take some of those, that food scraps out of people's garbage and actually produce, you know, either compost for us or compost that it can eventually be sold or whatever it may be. I think that's there's a flaw in our system locally there. So there's not necessarily an organization attached to that or anything. That's just a cause I think I'd like to move forward.
Well, you have no idea how much that is near and dear to my heart and my listeners' hearts, because Alyssa LaChance is here locally in Columbia Falls. She's an entrepreneur. She's a rock star millennial. I just saw her at Free the Seeds and she looked great and she was touting her business. And she is definitely in the top three downloads consistently on my show, right up there by Jean-Martin Fortier, who, all right, yeah, he's got a lot. And then Megan King, the creative vegetable gardener, but Alyssa LaChance. And she started a business like that here. And it's near and dear to my heart because I work in a school district who serves, has a salad bar and a fruit bar for kids every day. There's, I think, 2,000 students in the district, or 2,000 including all the teach, 400 staff members and 1,600 students or something. It's a huge district. We don't compost any of it. And then my husband wants me to buy dirt. And I'm like, oh, if I could just bring home the compost just from my school district. And my vice principal was laughing at me. She's like, what are you holding? And I'm holding the compost from my apartment that I was taking out to my car the other day. And she's like, what is that? And I'm like, I take my compost home. There's no way I'm throwing this in the garbage. So definitely near and dear to my heart and probably coming soon. And maybe some listeners on Long Island will reach out to you and you guys can get that started there. So how about you, Aiden?
All right. Well, this is, I'm going to take a leap into some pretty deep waters here, but, and this is way outside of the realm of my everyday thinking. So, but I would say if we could just like reevaluate the way we subsidize agriculture, whether that means, yes, you know, changing the type of agriculture we subsidize or just doing away with subsidies altogether, because, you know, when you fly, if you fly from New York to Montana or California or anywhere, it's just mind-boggling the scale of, like, you know, just corn and soy. And it's hard to believe that that is really, you know, that, I mean, I guess it is feeding us in the sense of, you know, confined animal farms or anything like that, but it's just unreal. And so I think if we could either end those subsidies to kind of create like a more organic patchwork of farming like we used to, or subsidize, you know, ecologically inclined diverse farms. But you know, like I said, this is way outside of my everyday realm of thinking, and I'm sure it would be really complicated to enact a change like that. But yeah, that's just, you know, going back to less input intensive farming and farming where it looks more like food coming off of the farms than, you know, industrial products.
Well, you are not the first person to say that in answer to this question on this show. And a couple of people have even written books about it. Like Liz Carlisle wrote a book called The Lentil Underground. And it talks about, if we know these are the best practices, why aren't we using these for best practices? And definitely, but as my new favorite teaching podcast always ends her show, it's not going to be easy, but it's going to be worth it. So it might not be easy. It might be complicated to change those subsidies, but that is definitely like a big key to what needs to being done. And also the way farmers can get loans for seeds, because there's a lot of people that talk about, you know, if you're getting crop insurance or if you're getting, you know, if you're buying seeds from a company, they require you to do this, that, and the other thing, or they require you to buy those treated seeds like you were saying earlier. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Sure.
All right. Well, not that you guys haven't shared like a million golden seeds and just total inspiration for listeners, whether they have a backyard farm or a big farm, or because a lot of my listeners are definitely people who are looking for production, how to increase their production. Like, so that's the other thread. Besides being green future growers, I know a lot of people listen to my show to figure out how can they make the hard work that they do to grow more food easier. And I think you have both shared a lot of cool tips like that, but do you have like just a quick inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden?
Well, the food's gonna taste a lot better. Like, it's hard to find good quality salad, like just salad greens or tomatoes or anything. Honestly, it's weird. Like, I have a hard time buying any produce even in the dead of winter beyond like maybe like a cabbage or something like that, you know.
I'm totally with Aiden on that. I was gonna say the same thing, and that's frankly, I mean, you know, a lot of the season extension stuff that we push Aiden to do is because of that. I agree with Aiden that in the, you know, the grocery store this time of year, it's pretty rough. And anything that, you know, that we can offer, even if it's, you know, one or two items, is such a dramatic improvement. So I would agree that the just the flavor you'll get is worth it. Go for it.
Yes. Our health food store's motto used to be, it's all about the taste. And for sure, things definitely, not only do they taste better, but there's that, like, from growing it yourself makes you make it taste just a tiny bit better. And that's true for sure. Like, a lot of, like, our first garden goal's challenge was grow enough of like one thing for the season so you don't have to buy it at the store. And like, Mike grew enough this year that I pretty much didn't have to buy any produce from August until Christmas. Like, he really grew a lot. And that's our goal, to buy as have to buy as little produce, because yeah, the taste is just incredible. And when you open, like, Mike cans pickled beets for me, and that's what I use instead of tomatoes in the winter of my salads, because I just can't put a store-bought tomato on a salad. And opening up that can and tasting those beets from the summer is so good. So I cannot thank you both so much. I know this interview probably went a lot longer than you were expecting, but it's going to be, I know, in the top listen to. People are just going to love it. I hope people, do you want to tell people how do they get to Young's Farm if they're on Long Island? Because New York is definitely, I have a lot of listeners from New York, and how to connect with you guys and whatnot, your website.
To get to Young's Farm, if you're on Long Island, take the LIE to exit 41 North, and you go up 107 about 4 miles and make a right on Hegeman's Lane. It's the only farm on the block. Can't miss it. And then our website is youngs.farm. Nothing else, just youngs.farm. And my email is tim@youngs.farm if anyone wants to reach me specifically. And I am not on Instagram or Twitter or anything like that. Aiden's dismay. Aiden?
Yeah, you can email me if you have questions about growing. My email is Aiden, that's AIDAN @youngs.farm. And I'd love to answer some questions if anybody has questions related to varieties or anything. You know, if you do have listeners in the Long Island area, they might be interested in what varieties we're using. And yeah, I'd love to share that information.
Do you have, a CSA, right? Like if people want to sign
we
up
do
for
not.
A CSA?
No, that's okay.
Okay, I'll take that out.
We are fortunate enough that we sell almost everything right out of the store on site here. So just as if it were a regular market. And occasionally we sell, I mean, I would say maybe 5% or so is wholesaled, you know, but most is sold right here. And then we have a commercial kitchen, so we do a lot of value add stuff too with the produce, the excess produce. So.
Can I ask really quick about the commercial kitchen? Like, was that hard to get started or did it come along? Have you always had that? Or?
To go way back to the beginning of the episode with a brief history of the farm, when my mother-in-law and her sister started selling things on site, it was originally just literally, you know, a stand, like a table with, you know, covered from the sun. Her father was the main farmer at that point and said, you know, you can sell whatever excess you have, whatever excess we have locally. And they were making as much money as he was trucking it to the city. So then they stopped trucking it in anymore and moved a building down close to the road. And originally we were just selling produce. And then soon after that, they got into a little bit of baking. So they did pies and cookies and stuff like that. There was a variety of kind of kitchens and houses on the properties. They had migrant workers back then. Some of that was converted into a commercial kitchen. And it's really expanded since then. That was in 1975, 1980 or so when they first started it. So now we have four full-time bakers, two full-time cooks, a bunch of part-time staff in the kitchen as well. We are well known for our pies. Thanksgiving's crazy. So like 6,000 pies in Thanksgiving.
So, holy cow, 6,000?
Yeah, we've somewhere between 5,500 and 6,000-ish the last few years. So.
Oh, wow. Here. All right.
Baking's a big business at Young's Farm as well, so.
And that's when I was a teenager. I mean, I graduated from high school in 1985. So that would have been when I was like going there in my high school years and stuff, just right about then. So, well, thank you guys so much for coming on and you have a wonderful day. And like I said, I think this will post about Mother's Day because I want to make it a tribute to my mom who really, really was bugging me to get you on here.
You're
so
very welcome,
thank you,
Jackie.
So much.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you. It was fun.
Well, thank you. Oh, well, cool. Well, podcasting is always fun. All right, you guys
Bye-bye.
Have a great day. All right, thanks. Bye. FreeGardenCourse.com. Mike and I have developed some lessons to help you create your very own organic oasis. We'll guide you through the steps to build your perfect natural landscape, an edible earth-friendly yard, a sustainable deep-bed garden, or even start a small profitable market farm. We'll show you how to save time, lower your produce bill, collect usable data, eat healthy, nutritious food with minimal labor, use the most effective and efficient production methods currently being used in backyard gardens as well as market farms, and maybe even help you find some profitable markets. We've designed it to save you time, lower your produce bill, and help you eat healthy, nutritious food. There's checklists, there's outside reading, video assignments. You can join the online Facebook community where there's lots of people from around the world to help you get your garden started today. So remember, freegardencourse.com. If you know somebody who would benefit from the Organic Gardener podcast, we would just love it if you would share it with a friend. Thanks again for listening, and remember to grow.